I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, COVID-19 arrived in the U.S. at a time when our defenses were down. Whose fault is that, and how does it complicate our effort to get the spread of the virus under control? We'll spend this hour with Ed Yong, science writer for The Atlantic, who 2 years ago wrote about how unprepared the U.S. was for a pandemic because of financially starved public health systems and the just-in-time delivery model of hospitals. We'll talk about what we can learn from this pandemic that could serve us during the next one, because pretty much every expert says there will be a next one. Our conversation starts after a short break. When you think back to your daily life and your long-term plans, say, 6 months ago, I'm guessing you could not have imagined the way things look at this particular moment. You probably did not expect to be wearing a mask to work or working from home or not being able to find work. We couldn't have predicted the precise details of when and where COVID-19 would spill over from its animal host into a vulnerable human population. But in terms of the terrible toll it has taken on the United States, that's on us, because experts say pretty much everything that has gone wrong with the U.S. response was both predictable and preventable. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. 2 years ago, science writer Ed Yong wrote an article for The Atlantic to sound an alarm about just how unprepared we were to handle a pandemic, given existing burdens on an underfunded public health system and the time it has always taken to cook up a workable vaccine for an infectious disease. Now, Yong is writing to explain all the mistakes in the U.S. response to the pandemic and to point to the things we will need to get to get fixed in order to get through this crisis and ensure we are ready for the next one. His article, The Anatomy of an American Failure, appears in the September issue of The Atlantic. Ed, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
You call President Trump a comorbidity of the COVID-19 pandemic. What do you mean by that?
A comorbidity is a disease or a problem that happens alongside the main disease that adds to it, that makes it worse. And I think we can see that at work here in terms of the federal response to COVID-19. The government has repeatedly abdicated its responsibility to its citizens. Trump has not taken the lead. He has not helmed any sort of workable plan to control COVID-19. Instead, he has repeatedly lied. He has tried to shift the blame onto China or the WHO or to whoever else he can. He has left state governors and city mayors on their own to come up with their own plans. And he has not tapped the extensive well of experts at his disposal. Indeed, he has actively silenced and suppressed many of them, including those who work in the CDC. Trump is not the only reason why America has failed at this pandemic so badly, and I'm sure we will talk about that, but he is central to it, and his mistakes and his deficits of both leadership and character have cost the country dearly.
Well, you talk about him blaming China. He often talks about having closed borders to visitors who had been in China where the outbreak originated. That sounds, or it might sound to folks, like a logical step. Can you give us some context for why it's not necessarily the most effective way to stop the spread of a global infection in 2020?
Yeah, so I agree that it sounds very intuitive. We know that air travel helps to carry infected people from one place to another, and so easily allows a virus that starts, an outbreak that starts in one continent to reach others. So, of course, it sounds sensible to restrict travel. The problem is that travel bans historically and currently with this pandemic have largely failed to either control the spread of viruses or of travel. Firstly, they're often very porous, and that was the case with the travel ban that Trump enacted against China. It was so porous that tens of thousands of people traveled to the U.S. from China anyway. They're often enacted way too late. So in this case, the ban was put in place after Sparks of the outbreak had already reached the US. And then in general, they're not very effective at restricting travel. People find their ways around travel bans. If the bans are announced, they tend to trigger a wave of worried people who are trying to reach their destinations before the enforcements come in. We saw that when Trump tried to put in a ban against Europe later on during the outbreak. So ironically, travel bans do create travel. And I think probably the most dangerous thing about them, they might work if you're like a far-off remote island nation like New Zealand or Fiji, but they're not that effective in the US, and they can create a false sense of security. So someone like Trump gets to put in a travel ban without putting in the other measures that actually help to contain outbreaks, like a reliable testing infrastructure. You put the ban in, and you get this false sense of security that it sounds like you've done a lot, but you actually haven't. And then the virus is allowed to spread beneath your nose without you noticing, while you think that you have already contained it. And that seems to be very much what happened to America in the early months of this year.
The president on multiple occasions has stated that the virus at some point will simply disappear. It seems as if virtually no expert believes this at the moment. Is there any way to assess whether President Trump actually believes it? Does that matter at this point?
I mean, it's difficult to get inside the president's head. I certainly don't think it matters whether he believes it or not. I think that he, I would guess that on some level Trump understands that he is over his head, but maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't. I genuinely don't think it matters. What matters are his actions and the consequences of them. By acting as if by repeatedly downplaying the threat of this pandemic, saying that it's not so much of a problem, saying that cases are going to be down to zero, saying that the virus is going to go away on its own, Trump sort of disarms the public. He creates a false sense of security. He erodes the sense of purpose and understanding that the American public desperately needs right now. Like when a pandemic happens, when any epidemic happens, people need clear, consistent, and evidence-based information from their leaders. In short, they need to know the truth. And Trump has not provided that. He has lied repeatedly about the virus, and I think that that fractures the communal American understanding of the pandemic and what is needed to control it.
All right. The United States now accounts for 25% of all the diagnosed COVID-19 cases on the planet. We are 4% of the population. Does that at least suggest we're diagnosing and recording every American who's being infected?
No, far from it. I think one of the truly staggering things about the statistics we're seeing, which are already so high, is that they are clearly underestimates. So we have, what is it now, 5 million cases at least. So there's two shocking things about that number, obviously. One is that it was already so high, 5 million people infected around the country. But the other is that I can't tell you what the actual number is because we still don't know. We know it's much higher than 5 million. We know that plenty of people who have been infected simply haven't been able to get tested. I've written about a group of COVID patients called the long haulers, the people who have been struggling with this virus for months on end. They haven't been sick enough to go into an intensive care unit to, require a ventilator, but their lives have been ruined by waves of symptoms that roll in and out for months on end with no respite in sight. And many of these people are not among those counted 5 million. Many of them, got sick in March and weren't at all able to get a test. But they have clearly COVID-19 symptoms. And, I think it just shows there's thousands of them, tens of thousands of them. It clearly shows that even the horrific numbers that we are grappling with are just a fraction of the total cost that this pandemic has wrought upon the country.
It's interesting when you talk about these people who are struggling with COVID for weeks or many months at a time. We all understand that shutdowns have cost the country economically. They've cost jobs and productivity. But I was thinking about the fact that every once in a while, in ordinary times, somebody will come up with an estimate of how much productivity is lost every year to the common cold or things like that. No one is even really accounting for the fact that there are people who can't work either from their jobs or from home because they're quite ill for days or many weeks at a time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think this is something we really need to start grappling with right now because it's going to be a problem. It already is, and it's going to continue being a problem. So COVID-19, in the caricature of COVID-19 is that a small proportion of people get very ill and some of them die, and everyone else is fine and escapes with a mild illness. This is categorically wrong. For a start, a lot of the people who get severely ill, and even if they don't die, suffer from long-term lung, heart, and other problems that persist well after their discharge from hospital. And then you have cases like long haulers who have been sick for months on end. Are still, a lot of them are being expected to do their jobs but can't work. And in the main, this community of people who have like the months-long sicknesses and aren't hospitalized. A lot of them are young, fit, healthy people. They are like prime workforce age, and suddenly they've gone from peak of health, literally doing running all the time, to being bedridden and being unable to work and basically facing medium to long-term disability. And, I said there are tens of thousands. There are almost certainly more. And that is a significant and growing slice of the population. And, it worries me because America is not good at dealing with chronic long-term illness or disability at the best of times. So what are we going to do now that that population of people is going to bloom in the wake of this pandemic?
Why was the U.S. so late to ramp up effective and adequate testing capacity?
So I think there's a couple of problems here. The CDC did release, try and produce a test quite early on. One of the components of that test just failed, rendering it useless. Private labs tried to create their own alternatives, but they were strangled by FDA bureaucracy. And so the whole testing infrastructure just collapsed. There weren't enough. People couldn't get them. And so a lot of cases of the virus went undiagnosed. Testing criteria were overly stringent. And then by the time the country started to catch up, now the whole world is facing a pandemic and they're all competing for the same chemical reagents that go into the tests, the same swabs that are used to collect samples. There's a mask shortage. Obviously, healthcare workers need masks to take the samples for the tests. So the whole brittle system imploded on itself because of those early mistakes. And there's two views on this. I think first, like a lot of experts, even those who'd ran simulations about on like how a pandemic response might happen, a lot of them didn't consider that this would be the case, that this sort of cascade of failures would mean that this country, which is so biomedically powerful, would fail to create a very simple test.
All right, let's get back to the second reason for all this in just a moment with my guest, Ed Yong, who covers science as a staff writer at The Atlantic. His article, Anatomy of an American Failure, appears in the September issue of the magazine. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour covers science as a staff writer at The Atlantic. Ed Yong's article, Anatomy of an American Failure, appears in the September issue. Ed, you were saying before the break that, you know, one problem here is that almost no one predicted the sort of cascade of failures that we have seen at every level, each one really amplifying the next to come along. And the second reason that things have turned out so badly?
Right. So the second point is that actually each part of that cascade was foreseen by some people. So I talked, just as one example, I talked about how when the CDC's tests failed, private labs tried to jump in but were strangled by bureaucracy from the FDA. People had warned about exactly this problem and suggested there should be like solutions, there should be ways of actually getting private labs involved should an outbreak happen. But no one took action on that. And I think the problem is that every piece of failure in the US response to this pandemic was foreseen by some people, and many folks had a kind of big picture uniting many of these pieces. But I think the problem is complex enough that a lot of people missed the entire picture and didn't appreciate just how cyclical these problems can be, how much they can compound each other. So, you know, with testing, if you run out of masks, you can't do enough tests. If you can't do enough tests, you then miss the spread of the virus in the communities. So then more people turn up to hospitals sick. And now you have doctors and nurses working overtime. So they use up the equipment they have. And now you have even fewer masks to begin with. And the whole thing then just spirals out of control. And I think that the testing problem then is a microcosm of the entire pandemic response in the US, where a lot of individually predictable and preventable failures amounted to something really, really catastrophic when added together.
A lot of the heavy lifting of that response has ultimately fallen to local public health departments. And there's been a lot of thinking in recent years that public health expenditures were somehow wasteful. You found better contact tracing capacity in the Democratic Republic of Congo than in the state of Maryland?
Yes, contact tracing was crucial during recent Ebola outbreaks. And actually, it's something that a lot of people, a lot of poorer nations, together with NGOs like the WHO, know to do really well. In a lot of these places, healthcare is much more threaded through communities. So, you know, the idea is that you're trying to keep people from getting sick in the first place, rather than just outsourcing all healthcare to hospitals, to treating people who have already become sick. Whereas in the US, it's the opposite is sort of true. The focus of most of the of America's incredibly high spending on healthcare goes towards hospitals, goes towards treating people who are already sick instead of preventing them from becoming sick in the first place. That latter aspect is the work of public health, and public health, as you say, has faced decades of disinvestment now, because when it does its job well, we don't notice. All we get is, you know, the beautiful miracle of a normal, healthy day. And we forget all the work that goes into making that happen, the sanitation and vaccinations and, you know, the control of food and waterborne illnesses, the stopping of outbreaks, testing and tracing that we've seen now is so lacking. The better public health does its job, the more people don't notice, and the more it like tragically makes the case for its own diminishment. And that's what we've seen. You know, we have pulled funding away from public health, jobs have been lost, and now when we need them the most, where are they? You know, people are having to recruit contact tracers from a pool of volunteers. This is, you know, we're paying the consequences now for decades of disinvestment.
There are some other things that seem completely outside the scope of epidemiology or public health, but still have had unintended consequences. We spend a lot of time indoors, and in this country, it's mostly in places without a lot of outside air circulating. Many office buildings, the one I work in, there's no window that opens anywhere.
So folks who study the connections between architecture and health have been saying for a long time that we have sick buildings. Since I believe the 1970s, the need to conserve energy has led to buildings being designed to suit engineers, but not to suit human health. So ventilation rates are too low. Windows often are not allowed to open, and ventilation is important. Without it, what happens is pollutants and pathogens are allowed to build up indoors at the cost of our own health. So this is another one of these issues that people have been talking about for a while. Experts in the fields have said this is a thing that we need to fix, and not enough attention has been paid to it, which creates another vulnerability that something like COVID-19 can exploit. It is not a surprise that the risk of getting the virus from someone else who is infected is much higher indoors than outdoors. And partly that's because indoor environments have crowds and prolonged proximity. But it's not just a factor of the virus, it's also a factor of the environments that we have built for ourselves.
It tends to make news when a famous or very privileged person gets COVID-19. And then there's talk about how the pandemic is this great equalizer. And while it's true that any one of us could get sick, you explain this outbreak has magnified virtually every inequality that already existed in the U.S.
Yes, I think for a lot of Americans back in March, a lot of people took it seriously when people like Tom Hanks got sick, or when basketball teams got sick. But this pandemic has disproportionately hit poor communities, disabled communities, Black and Brown and Indigenous communities. And again, this is simply a magnification of inequities that have been brewing throughout American history for years, decades, and even centuries. So the fact that the pandemic has infected and killed Black people at much higher rates than white people, isn't just about what's happened this year. It's about the fact that healthcare has been pushed away from Black communities, deliberately so, since, at least to the end of the Civil War, if not much longer than that. Even after the war, access to healthcare was deliberately pushed away from Black people. It carried on throughout the Jim Crow era. It carries on now. In recent years, we see it in the opposition to the Affordable Care Act, which would have allowed, which would have disproportionately benefited people in these communities and reducing these long-standing health inequalities. And again, this is a legacy problem that is manifesting in the moment. The reasons why Black people are so much more likely to contract COVID is nothing to do with Blackness itself. It has to do with, impoverished communities. It has to do with the fact that so many of them work in these so-called essential jobs, and therefore cannot just work from home like a lot of us do can, cannot take the steps that a lot of more privileged Americans have been able to take to keep themselves safe. Again, a long historical problem manifesting in this very current crisis.
We understand that by definition, folks living in nursing homes will be more vulnerable to infections like COVID. But what kinds of preventable, predictable problems have really contributed to and exacerbated the problem?
Again, nursing homes have been understaffed for a long time. They've been under-resourced. We know that they're crowded places. They often don't provide the standards of care that they should do. it's not because people people aren't trying. A lot of it is just because they don't have adequate resources, because we don't pay enough attention to the most vulnerable members of our society. Also, nursing homes, a lot of the staff who work in nursing homes are immigrants who have been deterred from their work and from their place in this country through 4 years of harsh anti-immigrant rhetoric and policy. And so, we have this situation where we've kind of already pushed, pushed elderly people to the margins of society, not provided them the care that they should be receiving, and then foisted that care onto other people who are also marginalized and vulnerable. And then in the midst, when this pandemic happens, when we know that the virus disproportionately kills elderly people, you would have thought that resources would have been therefore disproportionately applied to nursing homes and long-term care facilities, which is of course not what it not it is not what actually happened. Again, we allow inequalities to build, and then in the middle of a crisis, we do not address them, and then lo and behold, something like 40% of deaths in this country from COVID-19 taken place in those kinds of facilities.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So we are all trying to figure all of this out in a climate just rife with false information. Why are social media such ideal tools for spreading fake information, either out of malevolence or out of simple ignorance? I'm not sure that everybody spreading bad information is doing it deliberately to mislead other people.
No, and I think indeed many of the people who are spreading misinformation, even those who are actively trying to do so, really think that they are right. But the problem with social media, everything from Twitter to Facebook to YouTube, is that they're governed by amoral algorithms that are designed to keep people's attention and engagement. And they do that by serving increasingly extreme, polarizing, and attention-grabbing content, even if that happens to be wrong or dangerous. Again, we've known about these problems for years. People have written news pieces and features about it. Even, Facebook's own internal documents show that they recognize this problem, that that these sites are essentially radicalization engines, and but nothing has been done. And so, in a situation like this pandemic, when people are already desperate for information and are caught in what researchers have described as a vortex of fear and anxiety, they constantly want to find out more. These platforms are serving them with information that just adds to that fear and anxiety because it is just often wrong or extreme. And this is a huge problem. I think it is something that a lot of folks, even who work in pandemic preparedness, are not prepared to fight. That we need to treat, the WHO talked about this problem of infodemics accompanying epidemics, and they're right. But we don't have like the surveillance networks that would spot a brewing infodemic the same way that we have networks that look for emerging infectious diseases. That problem is just not taken seriously in the way that it should be.
Whose job should it be to control and monitor for an infodemic? Is that something the CDC should handle? Should the FCC be looking at this? Should there be some kind of intergovernmental organization?
I actually don't know the answer to that. I feel like probably all of the above, but certainly, like if you mentioned the CDC, like I think the question we should ask ourselves is like, why not? If we are treating this as we talked about comorbidities earlier. If you treat this information problem as a comorbidity of the physical sickness, then why shouldn't the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also take on this responsibility? Like, you can't deal with the disease and the spread of the virus without also dealing with the social misinformation problem. And I think that's one lesson we have to learn from the pandemic, and that we've already been talking about in this hour, right? There's the biomedical side to the problem, but there's also the sociological side, the inequalities, this spread of misinformation. And I think that a lot of people have focused on the former to the exclusion of the latter, and that creates weakness, that makes us vulnerable, because the biological problem is inextricable from all the other stuff, from the social networks, from inequalities, from Trump himself. Like, all of these things are tied, and we need to address them all.
Well, I was going to say, even if we are trying to turn only to official sources, our president and our governor and our local health agency might all be giving us different messages.
Yeah, and I think that actually has been a huge problem with this pandemic. That this, in the main, of course, the official, well, not the federal government, but say the CDC and the WHO have been better than your average source on social media. But I can't, I wish I could be more definitive about that without feeling the need to caveat it. Like, of course, also those sources were also, giving weird information about masks early on. They have been sort of slow and perhaps too absolute about certain public health measures, which have then had to be reversed. Now, of course, scientists are trained to review new information and to change their minds as new evidence comes across. So we should expect messages to change as we learn more about the pandemic and the disease behind it. But we need to be exceptionally clear about uncertainties and nuances early on, so that when we do have to change our minds, it's not this confusing flip-flop.
Ed Yong covers science as a staff writer at The Atlantic. His article, Anatomy of an American Failure, appears in the September issue. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Ed Yong, covers science as a staff writer at The Atlantic, which will feature his article, Anatomy of an American Failure, in the September issue. The really fascinating thing to keep in mind here, Ed, is that as bad as it is, it could be worse. You remind us that a lot of businesses took matters into their own hands before government mandating for social distancing and that sort of thing. We have changed the way we lived, and it's still pretty bad.
Yeah, I think this is one of the big tragedies of this year, that in the main, the American public really did take action, and they did it in this incredibly collective way that speaks against this like stereotype of the country as being unfailingly individualist. A lot of places did the right thing before leaders told them what the right thing to do was. We see this in the economic data, which shows downturns before the launch of social restrictions. And this was all done with this implicit contract that we, the people, are going to make a sacrifice to our normal lives, to our financial well-being, to our emotional and mental well-being, so that we can buy the country time to not inundate hospitals, to allow the curve to flatten, to allow time for the government to sort out the lack of protective equipment, but to get testing in place, to create an infrastructure that would allow America to gradually and safely begin reopening in the knowledge that the virus could be detected and suppressed. And that sacrifice was wasted. Americans did their part, and the government threw that sacrifice away because it didn't come up with a coordinated plan. And we're seeing the consequences of that now. Those reopenings were rushed. A second surge of cases took off. And we're in this weird situation where not that much has changed. So things are a little bit better, but the country is still struggling. And we're entering the fall into a position where schools and colleges are having to think about reopening. And they're having to think about reopening in a context when the virus is still spreading among communities because the government didn't do enough. I think this should be a source of just national outrage. Like, people really tried. And, for all the politicization of the pandemic, a lot of people really tried. A lot of people are still really trying to do their part, and that their efforts are not being rewarded.
Over the weekend, Ed, headlines broke that in the first couple of weeks of July, 100,000 American children tested positive for COVID-19. This feels like relatively new information, at least in that form, when all along we've heard a lot about how children are scarcely affected by this. What should we make of this information as so many parents are trying to decide what to do and are still on the fence about the school year?
It's so hard, and I go back to what I said earlier. I'll answer this question, but I do want to reiterate that this is the result of America's leaders foisting these horrible decisions onto people, onto parents, onto schools, onto colleges. We should not be in this position. Now, about children, it is still true that children are less likely to experience severe illness, but than adults or than elderly people. But they can still contract the virus. I think there was still an open question in those early months, the last time I spoke to you all, about whether what role children play in the transmission of COVID-19. And I think there's a lot of data here, and I personally haven't done the reporting yet to be confident about giving you a firm statement about what schools and parents should or should not do. It varies so much across the country, depending on local levels of transmission. As we said before, this is a patchwork pandemic that plays out differently across the country. But, in terms of what you said about there being a lot of infections detected in children, this seems to not be gelling with what we've heard before. One thing I've written recently is that a wider pandemic is a weirder pandemic. So if you allow the pandemic to run out of control, what happens is that supposedly rare events start becoming actually like common enough that you really notice them. Like if you have 5 million people with this virus, something that affects only that happens like 0.1% of the time will still affect 5,000 people. So the more America fails to control COVID-19, the more things that actually still are relatively rare will become a huge problem. And this is another cost of the pandemic that I don't think we talk enough about. Like the more we let it linger, the more strange, unusual, hard to explain, and very troubling outcomes we're going to see.
Every day, headlines break about another confirmation that hydroxychloroquine is not an effective treatment for COVID-19. How did the early rumor that it might be spread so effectively that it made its way to the President of the United States and he publicly endorsed it?
It's quite ludicrous. So it starts with a very small and severely flawed study. That was published in a reasonably minor scientific journal, but because the incentives in modern research are such that people get, that people are incentivized to do occasionally small and shoddy work, and that there's, especially in the pandemic, there's a lot of incentives for researchers to make inflated claims about their work because the entire world is paying attention. We sort of see that happen with the hydroxychloroquine saga. So this small study that might otherwise have been ignored starts doing the rounds. People pay attention to it. The lead researchers start talking it up, and then it winds its way through the US through this really convoluted Rube Goldberg machine of credulity that includes a lot of conservative pundits. It includes Fox News. It includes Dr. Oz, and Elon Musk, and it eventually gets to Donald Trump, who I think has always been looking for the easy out. You know, the steps that actually that would actually control the pandemic, require effort. They require attention, and it's so much easier to think, oh, here's a miracle drug that will save everyone, and we don't need to bother with the rest. And I think, you know, this is a failure of Trump. It's certainly a failure that he has continued to tout this despite large studies showing that it doesn't work. But it's also a failure more generally that people have looked towards the biomedical silver bullet, thinking that some new drug is going to save them. After I published my first big piece on the pandemic about how it will end, I had a call from a retired military high-ranking official who literally just said to me, "But okay, that's all fine, but we're going to have drugs, so it'll be okay." That's not how it works. Like I've pointed out in this new piece, there are so many foundational flaws throughout American society. We've talked about some of them, architecture, inequalities, that we need to address. We can't just wait for the magic medicine that is going to make things better.
Of course, you will be aware that there are still people who don't believe what you are reporting on. And I know it's a concern of yours because you want people to have accurate information. Have you learned anything in the course of your reporting on this about how to communicate this information to people who really don't want to hear it?
I think all we can do is to be honest with people. I have had emails throughout my time reporting this pandemic, accusing me of liberal bias or writing political hack pieces. All I want is to help. The people in this country are my friends, my family. I have not seen most of them for much of this year. And I am appalled and worried about what is to happen. And I'm trying my best to be honest and fair. And I think that comes through in the pieces, even when they have to, by necessity, showcase the many, many failures of this current administration and of Donald Trump in particular. One thing did make me so I got an email after this piece that we're talking about, how the pandemic defeated America, by someone I don't know, saying that they sent the piece to saying I sent this piece to my conservative father, expecting him to reply with the usual, "Why do you hate America so much?" And instead, he simply wrote, "Depressing, but helpful." And the reader ended with, if you, a writer in what is perceived as a liberal magazine, can make my father say helpful, that's a start. And I think by trying really hard to be fair and accurate, but also unflinchingly honest, in our reporting, we can make a difference, and we can reach people who might otherwise not hear us. And we just have to try, I think.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. To the extent, Ed, that our experience with this pandemic has perhaps permanently diminished the uniquely American sense of invincibility, will this position us better, the next time we are challenged by a novel outbreak of disease?
I hope so. I think America is famed for its exceptionalism, but it really has been exceptional only in the magnitude of its failure this time. And I don't wish to crush the national identity, but I think it is time for a painful reckoning and a bit of introspection that this country, which according to several well-respected rankings, was the most prepared in the world for a pandemic, has performed among the worst, certainly out of equivalently wealthy nations. And, you know, we can't just pretend that that is the fault of Donald Trump. He is one problem, but he is one among many. And if America reverts back to normal, as many people really want to happen, it's going to make the same mistakes again. You know, I wrote in my piece, normal led to this. Normal is the reason why so many vulnerabilities and weaknesses were allowed to accumulate unheeded and unattended, and why this pandemic has played out in such a catastrophic way. And, you know, it's a tragedy. It's also weirdly an opportunity to take stock of what went wrong, what we need to do to make a better world. And I think, you know, we can't just revert back. The only way out is through, and we need a clear-eyed vision of what a more resilient and more equitable society might look like, because that is the society that is going to stand up to the next emerging disease, as well as all the other problems that we still have: maternal mortality, the regular flu season, HIV, AIDS, you know, all of these things that are very much problems for us on the regular. We can address all of that by fixing the foundation rather than just hoping to go back to this, like twisted sense of exceptionalism.
Very quickly, before I let you go, how are you personally preparing for the onset of cooler weather in the next few weeks?
Well, I'm still staying mostly at home. You know, I'm stocked up on food. My mum sent me a massive box full of homemade masks, So I'm okay with that. I'm worried, honestly. I think it's going to be hard, and I'm just sort of psychologically steeling myself for it to be hard, because the colder it gets, the less we are able to sort of stay outdoors with our friends, and I worry about that. But you know, we have to be ready.
Ed Yong covers science as a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article, Anatomy of an American Failure, appears in the September issue of the magazine. Ed, great to speak with you again. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me. Stay safe.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And you can always listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.